Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
So if John McCain is elected president, what kind of foreign policy will he pursue? It's one of the most important questions right now, right? Would it be another 4 years of Bush and Cheney? If his foreign policy advisor staff is any indication, maybe it will be. His advisors include prominent so-called neocons like former UN Ambassador John Bolton, security analyst Max Boot, and my first guest today, Robert Kagan from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We will talk to Kagan in a minute, but first, here is a clip from a foreign policy speech by McCain on March 26th, in which he seemed to imply that President Bush has been too unilateral in his approach to the world.
President Bush has talked about our staying in Iraq for 50 years.
Maybe 100.
We've
been in South Korea. We've been in Japan for 60 years. We've been in South Korea for 50 years or so. That'd be fine with me.
So
as long as Americans are not being injured or harmed or wounded or killed, then it's fine with me. I hope it would be fine with you if we maintain a presence in a very volatile part of the world where Al-Qaeda is training, recruiting, and equipping and motivating people every single day.
All right, so that was not that clip. That was the famous John McCain 100 years in Iraq, if necessary, clip. Now let's listen to John McCain from March 26th talking about the U.S. and its allies on the world stage.
Leadership today means something different than it did in the years after World War II, when Europe and the other democracies were still recovering from the devastation of war, and the United States was the only democratic superpower. Today, we are not alone. There's the collective powerful voice of the European Union, and there are the great nations of India and Japan, Australia and Brazil, South Korea and South Africa, Turkey and Israel, to just name a few of the leading democracies. There's also the increasingly powerful nations of China and Russia that wield great influence in the international system. In such a world, where power of all kinds is more widely and evenly distributed, the United States cannot lead by virtue of its power alone. We must be strong politically, economically, and militarily, but we must also lead by attracting others to our cause, by demonstrating once again the virtues of freedom and democracy, by defending the rules of international civilized society, and by creating the new international institutions necessary to advance the peace and freedoms that we all cherish.
John McCain from March 26th. With me now is McCain Foreign Policy Advisor Robert Kagan from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, generally considered one of the intellectual architects of the Iraq war policy and a co-founder with William Kristol of the neocon think tank Project for a New American Century in the 90s. He writes columns for The Washington Post, Weekly Standard, and New Republic, and Dr. Kagan has a new book called The Return of History and the End of Dreams, published by Knopf. Dr. Kagan, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
And we'll get to McCain, but the first line of your book is "The world has returned to normal." What's normal?
It's a very radical statement, right? Well, normal is not what we expected after the end of the Cold War in two fundamental ways, I guess. One is we thought that the era of great power, competition, the old era of geopolitics was over, that we were in a new era of geoeconomics and it would be all about trade and there would be one superpower and we'd all sort of get along. Instead, we've seen since the 1990s the return of great power competition with the rise of China. Russia's now very much back in a kind of 19th century style of great power.
Not even 20th century, 19th century?
Well, I think that the world looks a lot more like the 19th century than the 20th century because you don't have communism. This isn't about communism and fascism. It's a much more traditional kind of great power competition. What you do have, and this is the other thing that we didn't expect, you do have the reemergence of kind of an old-fashioned autocracies. It's not communism, but you have what I think any 19th century Russian would have recognized as a kind of czarist rule in Moscow today. China has perfected a kind of autocratic system. And let's not forget that the end of history, when Frank Fukuyama spelled it out, meant that there would be no further ideological challengers to liberal democracy.
That was a famous book at the end of the Cold War, Francis Fukuyama, who was also a Republican official. He was in the first Bush administration, and he wrote that book called The End of History, The Last Man, in which he posited basically, okay, Cold War is over, that's it. With a few little stragglers here and there, the world accepts the basic premise of liberal democracy.
Right. And though, so I've,
and
I've,
capitalism.
I'm a good friend with Frank, so I'm not trying to get into a big argument with him, but my book is entitled The Return of History, because we do have, there is an alternative out there to liberal democratic capitalism. It's a kind of authoritarian capitalism. And when you have two of the most powerful great powers in the world as firmly entrenched autocracies, that is a different kind of world than we expected. More normal, I would say, if you look at the last 400 years of human history.
But your critics will say you've been making that argument for more than a decade, that your think tank, Project for a New American Century, founded in 1997, made the case that the world never really changed so much after the Cold War, and the U.S. needed to overthrow Saddam Hussein at that time, all premised on your enduring belief that what the world needs is more American power.
Well, I mean, I must say that if you'd asked me when Frank came out with his piece whether it was true that liberal democracy had triumphed, I would have said, yeah, I think that that is true and that there aren't alternatives. And even though I didn't think that was the end of history in a geopolitical sense, because I think power struggle goes on. I think that's an inescapable part of human nature, unfortunately. But I am surprised to see, because I believed the argument that as you had economic development and economic modernization, that you'd get political modernization too. But what we've seen in China and Russia is that that's not necessarily the case. Maybe in 100 years, that may turn out to be true, but a lot happens between now and 100 years from now, and now they seem to have found a formula of getting economic growth without giving up any political power, and that's what I think we're dealing with now. And frankly, the issue of Iraq is a separate issue. We could talk about Iraq, but I'm now talking about what is the configuration that we're going to be dealing with in the 21st century, and I think this kind of great power competition plus autocracy is the answer.
Is it more nuanced than that? We had a guest, Mark Leonard, this week.
Yeah.
Maybe you know him.
I know Mark very well.
Who just wrote a book about China, and he's arguing that China is not an old-fashioned totalitarian or authoritarian state, that there are, it's not a democracy, obviously, in our sense of the word, but that there are all these undercurrents of intellectual debate that do go on, that there are tens of thousands of protests even a year on the streets of China, and the government has to respond.
No, there's no question about it. But again, let's not, you know, have the wrong image of what an autocracy looks like. I mean, if you go back and look at the autocracies of the 19th century, whether it was Austria, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, there were protests and there were disagreement. There was intellectual ferment. It's only the communist system that insisted basically on a kind of mind control. That's not where China is today. But there is no possible challenge at the moment to the current government's rule.
Mm-hmm.
Do they allow debate? They have to, because autocracies are not unresponsive to popular will. It's just that there's no power struggle and no possibility of change of power.
And what about Russia? Technically, they just had elections. Medvedev just took over with Putin by his side. So it's change of power and it's not. But everybody's talking today about their first military hardware parade yesterday since the Cold War. What does that really mean? Because it is not the Soviet Union. But what is it?
Well, I mean, this is why, if you say, where did history end? Why could Frank Fukuyama write a book about the end of history? It's because what happened in the Soviet Union. That was the key turning point. And if you ask me where...
And all of Eastern Europe, right? Once people had the chance, they walked away.
But the Soviet Union was the key.
Correct.
Once the Soviet Union collapsed, then those nations moved in that other direction.
Right.
So now, if you had to say, where has history most obviously returned, it is also in Russia. Because here you have not only a return to an autocratic model, but really, as you say, with this military parade, a key part of what is fueling Putin's popularity in Russia and what supports his power in Russia is the sense that he is bringing Russia back. back in a big way, back to reestablish itself, not just as another European power, but as one of the world's two or three greatest powers. And you see this kind of Russian revanchism playing a big role both domestically in a political sense and in international sense, as you see now in the rising tensions in Georgia, for instance, where this kind of 19th century Russia wants a sphere of influence that doesn't let a country like Georgia join the West.
Robert Kagan, my guest on WNYC, his book, The Return of History, and he's a foreign policy advisor to John McCain. Now, the Democrats are already running on McCain as offering four more years of Bush and Cheney on foreign policy. So whether you like Bush and Cheney on foreign policy or not, is that accurate in your opinion?
Well, I don't think it's accurate, and I think that the speech that you quoted from is a clear signal that McCain understands a lot of what went wrong over the past 8 years, not the least of which was that the world had a perception that the United States was going to do whatever it wanted to do and whenever it wanted to do, and if anybody wanted to come along, fine. And we can't operate that way. And I think that what Senator McCain has made clear in that speech and in other statements is that we have to go back to, you know, as they said in the Declaration of Independence, having a decent respect for the opinion of mankind, and especially for democratic allies. And the other line in the speech, I don't know whether you quoted it, but I think it's very important, is not just that the United States has to listen to its allies, it has to be willing to be persuaded by its allies as well. I mean, I think we need a new grand bargain with our allies where, you know, it isn't enough to go and consult and then if they don't like it, go anyway. You really need to take their views seriously. You need to be persuaded by them if they are persuasive. For their part, they need to carry a bigger load in the overall effort to provide the common security. But I think that John McCain is very clear that we need to start fresh with a relationship not only with our allies, but also with Russia and China.
So what would that mean in a practical sense? How can McCain do better or different in cultivating all those countries?
Well, you know, just start with a clear sense that we understand what has troubled everyone. And by the way, in fairness to the Bush administration, you know, since Iraq, they've tried to repair the damage. And I think that, you know, Condi Rice has been out to Europe a lot and relations. I live in Europe and I can say relations with the allies are better. But I think we need to go beyond that. And I think we also need to start talking about linking up allies in different regions. And this is another part of Senator McCain's program. He talks about a league of democracies where it wouldn't just be our relations with Germany and England and France, but it would also include our relations with Japan and with India, with Brazil, and some of these countries that don't get as much attention in the world. But it is definitely, and the other concept is that's important, is the idea of America as an international good citizen. And that has to do with things like, are we going to be a positive force on climate change? Are we going to shut down Guantanamo and bring ourselves in line with what the civilized community thinks is appropriate on torture? I think that's the other thing that John McCain wants to do. And the world, I can tell you, living outside America, wants to see America as an international good citizen again.
Does he advocate shutting down Guantanamo? Do you?
Yes. In fact, he says many times and has said in Europe, where it is well received, that he would shut down Guantanamo on his first day in office. So I think that has clearly been a tremendous stain on the American character and damaged us in terms of our ability to persuade others to follow us.
This was when I was going to play the clip that we mistakenly played at the beginning about McCain, with McCain saying in response to a question that we would stay in Iraq for 100 years if necessary. He cited the model of the troops in South Korea all these years. Explain, as you understand it, what he means by that, because that scares a lot of people who think that he would just continue this, you know, ill-begotten policy.
Well, look, the other thing that he said, which you could also quote, is that he doesn't want to keep American troops in Iraq a minute longer than is absolutely necessary.
But that doesn't mean anything until you define what necessary is.
Well, and it's interesting, if you look at both what Barack Obama is saying and what John McCain is saying, I'm not sure, you know, there'll be a difference, and I think that Obama's approach might be more reckless, but both of them talk about, I mean, Barack Obama talks about leaving a force in place to deal with terrorists, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the question is, if you needed to have a residual number of American troops that were not in combat, that were there mostly as a kind of border watch. I mean, we've had troops in all kinds of countries. I'm sure Americans don't even know they're there now for decades. In the Sinai Peninsula, for instance, as a means of providing reassurance. And so I don't think that anybody would really object to that. The key thing is to get America out of a combat role. And I think that Senator McCain wants to do that as soon as it is responsible and possible. And his definition of that may be different than Barack Obama's definition.
Right.
Of
and
that.
There are risks right. on either side.
Absolutely.
Right? There are risks of getting out too early right. if it descends into some kind of chaos and with a big Al-Qaeda base
right.
that becomes threatening to the
exactly.
United States and to the region. But there are risks of staying in too long
of course.
And continuing to deplete the military.
Yeah.
Morning Edition had a feature this morning about a 56-year-old Vietnam veteran
yeah.
who they just allowed
yeah.
to enlist because
yeah.
they're short.
Yeah.
And, you know, and U.S. continuing to be seen as an occupier
yeah.
and everything
right.
else.
Right. Look, and I think Senator McCain's aware of all those problems. And, you know, to his credit, he didn't start complaining about the way the Bush administration was running this war a year ago or 2 years ago. He started complaining about it within three months after the intervention in 2003, that there weren't enough troops, that they didn't do what they needed to do, which I think would have gotten us out of there faster if they had done that earlier. There's been a lot of mistakes. I think people would have to decide whether they trust John McCain to know what went wrong. And you're exactly right. Somebody's going to have to make those very difficult judgments. So the question is, who do you think is best equipped to make those judgments?
By the way, I want to get some phone calls in for you. 212-433-WNYC, just a few minutes for phone calls for Robert Kagan this morning. But Democrats are saying McCain doesn't really have the foreign policy expertise he claims. He has this big reputation because of his personal history in Vietnam and everything else. But like when Joe Lieberman had to whisper in his ear at a recent appearance in the Middle East to correct him that Iran was not training al-Qaeda, that al-Qaeda is Sunni and Iran is allied with Shiites in Iran, that was a telling indication that this guy does not really have, you know, the nuanced, deep intellectual understanding of foreign policy that his reputation, which is more military, would have it.
Look, I mean, Senator McCain admitted that he misspoke immediately after that happened, and these things happen. I'm sure every candidate
but
is going to misspeak.
But you saw the tape. He first started defending that. The Iranians are backing al-Qaeda. And only when, you know, Lieberman came over and whispered to him what the real deal was, he kind of sheepishly walked away from it.
Look, it's going to the job of both campaigns is going to be to say that the other guy doesn't have what it takes. All I can tell you, and I mean, you know, you don't have to take my word for it, obviously, but in my experience, I'm amazed at the breadth of issues that John McCain knows very deeply. I'm a foreign policy expert, but I sometimes find myself in conversations with him about issues that he knows a great deal more about than I do. He's been traveling to Europe every single year. This is quite remarkable. Every year for the last 20 years, he's gone to this conference in Munich to meet with European allies. You know, there's nothing in it for him. His Arizona constituents don't care that he's there. He's interested in the world. I think that, you know, if you look at just how much attention he's paid to the world over the past few years and compare it to, and I don't fault Barack Obama. He was doing something else during that time. But, you know, McCain has had a real abiding interest in world affairs for over two decades now.
Aaron and Teaneck, you're on WNYC with Robert Kagan. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, good morning. To follow up on your good citizen responsibility view of the United States, how do you view the last 20 years since the Cold War ended and some of the huge opportunities we had in encouraging representative government and governance in the world? And do you think that we'll ever be able to repair that or take advantage of another opportunity? Or do you think the world will just slide into this authoritarian capitalism, which is almost like a corporatism, a stasis type government model?
Are you willing to pick apart democracy and capitalism? Aaron talks about authoritarian capitalism, which is certainly the Chinese model right now. And we always hear those two linked so much, certainly in Fukuyama's original End of History. Are conservatives willing to acknowledge now that sometimes capitalism comes with authoritarianism and it's not always a great combination?
You know, you're always in trouble if you want to talk to conservatives because I don't consider myself a conservative. So, but what I would say.
By the way, you're labeled, as you know, you are considered one of the founders of contemporary neoconservatism.
I understand that.
Do you reject that label?
I reject the label, but it doesn't do me any good, so I'll just go on with my life. I mean, there's not much I could do about it. I would consider myself a kind of classic American liberal when it comes to American foreign policy, and most of my critics in the 1990s were conservatives. You talk about John Bolton. John Bolton and I were on the opposite side of almost every single debate in the 1990s because he's a real conservative, and I'm sort of a liberal, so that's my problem. But anyway,
call me what you want. But he and you now, because this is
interesting. Well, he and me now, we're going to wind up disagreeing, too, because nobody understands that John Bolton is not actually a neoconservative, so that's another matter. But who cares, right?
But wait a minute, no, I think my listeners
care.
Yes, how is John Bolton not a neoconservative? You're both McCain advisors.
Well, I don't even know if Bolton is an official McCain advisor. That's another question. But I'm not sure that he actually is an official McCain advisor.
I read in the press, maybe it's wrong.
By the way, I wouldn't make too much of McCain advisors. I mean, I'd love to exalt myself, but McCain, you know, needs advisors like Tiger Woods needs of a golf instructor. I mean, he doesn't need a lot
right.
of he doesn't
but the perception yeah. is he's not picking on the so-called pragmatists
yeah.
for his foreign policy yeah. advisors. He's picking on the so-called neocons.
No, I get that, although I don't quite know what a pragmatist is either. I mean, pragmatic in pursuit of what is always my question. I mean, you can be pragmatic in pursuit of ideals. You can be pragmatic. Pragmatism is a style. It's not a goal.
Well,
right?
Baker Hamilton on the Iraq War versus Dick Cheney.
Well, Baker Hamilton had one pragmatic approach, which I think would have failed pragmatically, and the approach that was chosen was more successful pragmatically. But that's a debate we can have about pragmatism. Okay, you asked me a question a long time ago.
Capitalism.
Right. I do not think, and history gives you no reason to assume that capitalism must necessarily evolve toward political democracy. They obviously work well together, but we've always seen in the fascist era, there were, you know, the capitalists functioned perfectly well in fascist governments in Europe, and capitalism thrived in autocratic governments in Europe in the 19th century. I think, yes, this is why I'm a liberal, Brian. I do believe that eventually that kind of progress does come along, but I don't believe it's inevitable. And I think that the amount of time that it may take, I mean, we've made a lot of progress in humanity since the 14th century, but a lot has happened in the last 600 years, too, which we would rather not have seen. And when I try to think of progress, I think of the 20th century, which is one of the most brutal, awful centuries in the history of mankind, and yet we think of it as a period of progress. So I'm just a little skeptical that everything turns out as well as everybody wants it to.
Pat in Maplewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I find it really incredible that Mr. Kagan is trying to cast himself as Senator McCain as some sort of new thinker. He's part of the reason we're in such a mess. You know, the Project for a New American Century was part of the impetus for this wrong-headed policy that has gotten us into this miserable state that our country's in. And I just think that this is a case of a leopard trying to change its spots. It's just not going to happen.
Where's the credibility? Honestly,
well, first of all,
Mr.
I would probably
Kagan.
I'd be a lot more popular if I simply did just change my spots. I mean, I have a lot of people who were supporters of the Iraq War when by the way, the vast majority of people supported the Iraq War. You don't remember that anymore because they've all somehow disappeared and changed their spots. And the only people who are left, you know, getting beaten up for this are the people who didn't turn around and say, hey, I didn't really support that war or I was talked into it. I mean, you know, people talk about that Project for the New American Century where, by the way, among the famous signers of that letter included Robert Zoellick, the current World Bank chief, Rich Armitage, later famous as an opponent of the Bush administration from within the administration. You know, I don't have to go back and talk about the 77 senators who voted for the Iraq War.
But so far, and we're going to have to end on this, the Iraq War is being seen by most people as a disaster for the United States. Many more dead Americans than predicted, a real al-Qaeda in Iraq when there was none before, the U.S. as aggressor rather than victim of 9/11. And so the question is, for people like yourself and William Kristol, where is the credibility to make future policy?
You know, I happen to think that I still, regardless of what's happened, don't think we'd... It's easy to say, let's just roll the tape back, but history doesn't work that way. Saddam Hussein would have been in power now for another 8 years. I don't know what would have happened. I don't know how many thousands of people would have died in Iraq as a result. I don't know whether he would have invaded another country. I don't know what kind of weapons program he would have had. But by the way, I'm not insisting that anybody listen to anything that I say about foreign policy. I would never make that demand. And if people don't want to listen to what I have to say, I'm quite happy with that. I mean, it's a free country. I'm just expressing my views, and people don't have to pay attention if they don't want to.
Robert Kagan's new book is called The Return of History and the End of Dreams. It is published by Knopf. He is a foreign policy advisor to the McCain campaign. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Brian. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. Is commodity speculation pushing up the price of food? Stay with us.